glossary, but for terms relevant for emergency care and intake. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
The National Congress of American Indian says it welcomes the reopening of the federal government to restore stability to critical services to tribes. In a statement, NCAI said during the shutdown, the Indian Health Service largely remained open due to advance appropriations, but it's depending on Congress to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits, and that reopening the government restores funding to food assistance programs that many Native people rely on. The organization says temporary fixes are not enough and that data collected from tribes during the shutdown made clear how long-term lasting solutions and structural funding reforms are needed to honor tribal trust and treaty obligations. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 13th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings and Josh Salem.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto.
Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The Trump plan for Gaza, seven obstacles. The COP30 climate change conference is open. Oil and gas lobbyists are everywhere. And a U.S. attack on Venezuela seems less likely, maybe. First, seven obstacles to the Trump plan for Gaza. The Trump administration is trying to sell its Gaza peace plan to the UN Security Council. To succeed, it will have to hide or massage several facts on the ground that reveal major complications in the plan. First, the violence continues as uncertainties about enforcing peace loom large. At least 40 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli Defense Forces attacks and 1,500 buildings destroyed since the ceasefire started. Consequently, Hamas has not been disarmed as required. It insists it will only turn over arms to a Palestinian entity. But neither a Palestinian police force nor an international stabilization force with Arab country membership has yet to be established. As one Palestinian observer writes in the Atlantic magazine, no Arab country wants to enforce the ceasefire against Hamas and, quote, risk being cast as the aggressor. Second, Hamas is far from finished. It is taking over areas of Gaza where the IDF has withdrawn. That same observer writes, quote, the group is collecting unexploded munitions in order to rearm, is re-establishing command and control across its different units, repairing damaged tunnels, and ensuring that its grip on power is never threatened from within by Gaza's exhausted and deeply traumatized population. Third, Israel is engaged in major military operations in Lebanon and retains forces in Syria. Fourth, humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip is supposed to be unhindered, meaning about 600 aid trucks allowed in each day. So far, Israel is only allowing in 300 or fewer trucks a day. According to one report from the scene, only two crossings are open, and convoys are restricted to narrow, congested roads where commercial shipments are prioritized. Most operations remain hamstrung by prohibitive registration requirements that effectively ban most non-governmental organizations from taking part in the scale-up, according to a UN spokesperson. He said the UN is pressing all those with influence to lift these restrictions so aid can reach everyone in need. Fifth, the U.S. has taken over monitoring of aid shipments. The Civil Military Coordination Center, established under the peace plan, in which around 40 countries and NGOs participate, will seek to facilitate aid deliveries that until now have been hampered by closure of entry points and Israeli regulations that sharply limit the list of allowable aid. Sixth, the requirement in the peace plan of Palestinian statehood shows little progress. The Arab states will be journeying to Washington to learn whether Trump will be willing to pressure Netanyahu to accept that goal, a goal Netanyahu has always rejected. Seventh, the Palestinian Authority is slated to be the governing authority in Gaza after Israel's withdrawal, but it must first carry out reforms and show that it is in control. The COP30 Climate Change Conference has opened. Oil and gas lobbyists are everywhere. A research report in The Guardian finds that over the last 4 years of UN climate conferences, quote, roughly 5,350 lobbyists have mingled with world leaders and climate negotiators. The lobbyists worked for at least 859 fossil fuel organizations, including trade groups, foundations, and 180 oil, gas, and coal companies involved in every part of the supply chain, from exploration and production to distribution and equipment, unquote. The lobbyists represent all the major oil and gas corporations, and just 90 of those companies account for over half the oil and gas produced annually. This report comes as the 30th UN Climate Summit, COP30, opened in Belém in the Brazilian Amazon, where oil and gas exploration is among the major threats to the region's rainforests. Perhaps these lobbyists should be seen as stand-ins for U.S. corporate leaders, few of whom are attending the conference, and for the Trump administration, which for the first time is not sending senior officials to a climate change summit. But the administration is doing its best to torpedo it, urging delegates from other countries not to support any proposal that limits fossil fuels, commerce, and production of greenhouse gases. Trump has already done plenty of damage, working with the Saudis and others to kill a global plastics treaty and a proposed tax on global shipping pollution. However, U.S. cities and states and Democrats in Congress will be well represented. At the opening of COP30, Simon Steele, the executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, gave a stark portrayal of the price of failure on the climate crisis. He said, quote, "Not one single nation among you can afford this, as climate disasters rip double digits off GDP. To falter while mega droughts wreck national harvests, sending food prices soaring, makes zero sense economically and politically. Squabble while famines take hold, forcing millions to flee their homelands. This will never be forgotten as conflicts spread." A U.S. attack on Venezuela seems less likely. Maybe. CNN reports that at a classified briefing by Secretary of State Rubio and Secretary of Defense Hegseth, Congress members were told the administration is not currently planning to launch strikes inside Venezuela and doesn't have a legal justification that would support attacks against land targets. The opinion is said to have come from the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel, which has ruled that no land targets of any kind may be attacked. But continued attacks on alleged drug boats and possible future attacks on land targets in Venezuela are apparently not covered by this legal opinion. Nor does the legal opinion propose that the administration obtain authorization from Congress before using force. Nevertheless, U.S. attacks on alleged drug boats in the Pacific and the Caribbean have now reached 19, with an estimated 76 people killed. The flotilla of major naval ships stationed there continues to be augmented. The most advanced U.S. aircraft carrier, the Gerald R. Ford, which carries around 4,000 sailors, is due to arrive shortly, joined by three destroyers and several other ships. I note this because China just deployed its third aircraft carrier, the Fujian, which has many of the same features as the Ford. Why would the fort be in the Caribbean when it should logically be in the Pacific? And what could be the point of amassing so much firepower to sink small boats carrying civilians? There can only be two answers, either to intimidate the Nicolas Maduro government in Venezuela or to invade with the aim of regime change. The illegality of the U.S. boat attacks has affected U.S. relations with Britain. CNN reports that, quote, the United Kingdom is no longer sharing intelligence with the U.S. about suspected drug trafficking vessels in the Caribbean because it does not want to be complicit in U.S. military strikes and believes the attacks are illegal, unquote. Ordinarily, British intelligence assets in the Caribbean would assist the U.S. in identifying drug smugglers, but apparently no longer. This puts the British in line with the United Nations, whose head of human rights has called the U.S. attacks extrajudicial killings in violation of international law. In other news, Trump's confusions about nuclear weapons tests. Donald Trump's announcement before meeting with Xi Jinping in Korea a few weeks ago that the U.S. will have to restart nuclear weapons testing immediately and on an equal basis with Russia and China has prompted many questions. In Russia, Vladimir Putin said he would have to look into doing the same, though a spokesman said the Russians actually wonder about Trump's intentions. Trump apparently believes that both Russia and China have secretly been testing their nukes, which Moscow and Beijing deny. Some people suggest that Trump has confused testing of nuclear weapons and delivery systems for their reliability, such tests are allowed under the comprehensive nuclear test ban, with testing new weapons. That may well be, since Trump was already confused when he ordered the Pentagon, instead of the Energy Department, which controls nuclear testing, to begin tests. Brazil calls for an international fund to save rainforests. Brazil has called for the establishment of an ambitious fund designed to pay countries to keep their tropical forests standing. As many as 74 countries with tropical forests stand to gain a total of $4 billion a year if they leave their forests alone. If fully financed, the fund, called the Tropical Forest Forever Fund, would represent nearly three times the current volume of international forest financing. Brazilian officials say it will mobilize large-scale capital with sustained financial flows to conserve biodiversity. Whether the fund would be sufficient incentive for forested countries to accept it remains to be seen. At present, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, roughly 11 million hectares of forest ecosystems are disappearing every year. That's 0.27% of the 4 billion hectares globally, an extremely disturbing figure when you calculate the damage over the next 10 years. Speaking of Brazil, a nonprofit coffee industry watchdog group reports that the felling of tropical forests to make way for coffee plantations is causing immense environmental damage. Rainfall decreases, leading to crop failures and lower yields and ultimately higher prices for consumers. The director of Coffee Watch says, quote, "The ecologically destructive way we grow coffee is going to result in us not having coffee. Deforestation for coffee cultivation is killing the rains, which is killing the coffee," unquote. Deforestation, according to Brazilian scientists, is responsible for about 75% of the country's rainfall decline. Trump threatens Nigeria and South Africa. Donald Trump said he has ordered the Pentagon to prepare for possible action against Nigeria, which he says has not done enough to protect Christians from attacks by Islamic militants. "The Nigerian government better move fast before it's too late," said Trump. "If they don't, there's going to be hell to pay." Nigeria's leader begs to differ, citing the fact that Christian and Muslim populations are roughly equal and equally under assault. He might have added that Nigeria has many other sources of social division. A British doctoral student who has spent considerable time in Nigeria writes, quote, "I would never advise anyone to downplay the suffering of Christians who have experienced horrific attacks. I have seen and heard from many victims firsthand. But I have also seen the impact of similarly horrific violence against Muslim communities. To ignore the latter is to misunderstand what is really going on," unquote. U.S. intervention in Nigeria would be a tragic mistake, he writes. So why did Trump pick on Nigeria when Christians are under assault in a number of other countries? This writer offers an interesting answer, quote, "Trump's abrupt announcement reportedly was due to an emotional response to a segment about Nigerian Christians he saw on Fox News. He and his advisors likely feel that Nigeria is a place where the U.S. can flex its muscles in defense of Christians without incurring significant geopolitical risks. Nicholas Kristof's New York Times op-ed has the best quip about Trump and Nigeria. Quote, "Trump aid cuts are killing far more Nigerian Christians than Islamic terrorists are," unquote. Instead of sending in the Marines, says Kristof, all Trump has to do is restore the American aid that was estimated to be saving the lives of more than 250,000 Nigerians each year. Kristof adds that if Trump is really concerned about mass killings, he should pay more attention to Sudan, Myanmar, and China, and to victims of all faiths, not just Christians. As for South Africa, which is about to host a G20 meeting of the major economies, Trump says the country shouldn't be in the group at all. It's a communist tyranny, he says. He's still making the argument that South Africa is committing genocide against the country's white population, the same argument he is using to justify allowing South African whites and virtually no one else to enter the U.S. as refugees. Next, a dangerous impasse in Iran's nuclear program. Stephen Erlanger reports in the New York Times on the dangers posed by the absence of international talks on Iran's nuclear program. The 2015 nuclear deal has ended, and no one seems to know the status of Iran's nuclear bomb-making materials. Perhaps they were obliterated, as Trump claims, or more likely, Iran has them stored somewhere. One new suspected storage site has been declared off-limits by Iran to international inspectors. Iran is also expanding its missile production in anticipation of a resumption of the war with Israel. Whether either side can be restrained by its partners and neighbors is a vexing question. The U.S. doesn't seem interested in reopening talks with Iran, and Iran isn't interested in direct talks or in surrendering its right to enrich uranium. It would seem that there are no barriers to more fighting and no talking. Finally, two updates. Thailand suspended the implementation of a peace accord with Cambodia, which President Trump had claimed as one of the eight wars he has resolved. Two Thai soldiers were wounded by a landmine in the border area. "Everything must be stopped," said Thailand's foreign minister. And then there's Trump on Ukraine. In case you're wondering about Trump's latest thinking about the war in Ukraine, here's this. Fox News asked Trump what he would do in Ukraine, and he said, quote, "Well, what I would do is, we have tremendous military capability, and what we can do without planes is, to be honest with you, without 44-year-old jets, what we can do is enormous, and we should be doing it. We should be helping them to survive, and they're doing an amazing job," unquote. And there you have it. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. At Portland City Council's Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee meeting on Thursday morning, City Attorney Robert Taylor gave the committee an update on the investigation into the city's dealings with the controversial oil company Zenith Energy. It's being conducted by an outside law firm. The meeting coincided with a legal update, unexpectedly. Here's Attorney Taylor and some excerpts from the meeting.
Just this morning, we got a decision from the Court of Appeals related to the appeal that was filed by some advocates related to the Lux, the current Lux that has been approved. As you will recall, LUBA dismissed the appeal, and they found that granting the Lux was not a land use decision. The Court of Appeals this morning reversed that LUBA decision and found that granting the Lux with conditions, because those conditions were added, that made it a land use decision, and they remanded back to LUBA. And we expect further proceedings in front of LUBA on that matter. But that's just breaking news. We're still reviewing the decision from the Court of Appeals, but that's the current state of that litigation right now. I'm happy to answer any questions.
That's exciting. I didn't know we were having this presented on a timely day because we scheduled it a few weeks ago.
I didn't either. Yeah.
I like it. It's very dramatic, very intense. That's always fun. For clarity, you said that we're going to be getting the report back to council in February of 2026?
I think January or February.
Okay.
Just to sort of be candid about the expectations and...
Yeah, that's. I understand you're handling a few things at the federal level right now, so appreciate that. And I think now we can move into the public testimony portion. Good morning. Thank you for being here. Please state your name and any affiliations for the record.
Good morning. My name is Nick Caleb. I'm the climate energy attorney at Breach Collective. Also a registered lobbyist for the same entity. Thank you first in advance. Nice to see you all. Thank you for providing this forum for an update. Already, I am very happy that it happened because I learned some stuff I didn't know before, which makes me very excited. I mostly today wanna just kind of read a little bit of information into the record that I think is relevant for the investigation and hopefully is being considered. As has been mentioned in the past, we don't have a ton of information. We don't have a written scope of work about what's happening, which we'd love to have. And we now have some more details about how the relationship works with the city and outside counsel, which is important and good. I sent a letter to the mayor on June 20th after the first information request was satisfied about the initial design of this investigation, and basically sent a bunch of instances of what we thought are possible franchise agreement violations, including many instances of what under the franchise agreement I think would be called fraud and deceit upon the city. And there were no replies to that or an acknowledgement of receipt. And so I do have some questions about whether information like that will be shared with outside counsel. And I also wanted to just read into the record three examples of what I think are areas that the investigation should focus on to investigate whether fraud and deceit happened. So the first is in 2019, Zenith misled Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler's staff into believing false information. As reported by the Oregonian, quote, executives of oil terminal operator Zenith Energy left Portland mayoral aides believing falsely that the company's Willamette River facility no longer handled tar sands crude or shipped petroleum products to other ports. Also in 2019, Zenith falsely represented to Oregon DEQ that its expansion of rail infrastructure would result in no new throughput and no new increases in volatile organic compound emissions. As of the January 1st, 2025 Zenith work session, Zenith presented information that its total liquid fuel throughput had increased for the sixth straight years, directly contradicting that 2019 report. And then also more recently, Zenith was fined, as you all know, in December for using infrastructure illegally. And the details around that are really relevant to this because for 3 years, the city was denied the full scope of Zenith's activities. And under the franchise agreement, that concealment denied the city its rights to renegotiate or cancel the agreement. So there are multiple pieces of the franchise agreement that were likely violated. Anyway, we are concerned that this information, based on the first information dump, that this information will not be included in the investigation. I'm a little less concerned after hearing the city attorney's description of things, but would also like to find ways to put this information into the record and make sure that it's considered as a part of a full investigation. Thank you.
Thank you, I appreciate that. And if you could maybe bump that letter up for our offices, for everyone on the climate committee, just so we can review it again, that would be really helpful.
Happy to, thank you.
Thank you. Marnie.
Good morning, counselors. My name is Marnie Glickman. I'm the executive director of Braided River Campaign and a registered lobbyist representing the Braided River Campaign. I'm also a resident of District 2. We've heard a lot today about the topic of my testimony, which is transparency. We believe transparency and accountability are essential to healthy democratic government, climate justice, and economic justice. Transparency is also important because of Zenith's increasing oil throughput, hundreds of millions of gallons of oil through its bulk fuel terminal at the CEI hub. I'm going to bring three requests to you today, but before I share them, I want to repeat a quote that I know all of you have heard before. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis wrote in Harper's in 1913, "Publicity is justly commended as a remedy for social and industrial diseases. Sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants, electric light the most efficient policeman." That said, number one, we would like you to publicly disclose Cable Houston's full mandate. That means releasing documents describing the scope of work, timeline, and reporting protocols for the investigation to ensure true independence. Two, please remove document gatekeepers. We would like you to ensure Cable Houston has direct and unsupervised access to all relevant city records going back to 2017, removing the filter of staff whose past actions are under scrutiny. And third, we ask you to authorize Cable Houston to expand the scope of the investigation if needed. The inquiry must be broadened to examine Zenith's pattern of conduct since it began its operations in Portland, and to use the broad authority under Portland City Code 7.12.030 to compel disclosure of information, including Zenith's internal communications, that may reveal intent to mislead regulators or conceal outside of the scope of the franchise agreement. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to all the folks who made time to come and testify with us today. Robert, I have one more question for you, if you're willing to come back up, about the Cable Houston investigation, and then we will release you because I know you have a ton of work to do. I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more, just given some of the testimony, it raised some questions for me about specifically what the city asked outside counsel to investigate pursuant to our resolution, or if we can get some details on the scope of the investigation.
Yeah, thank you, Robert Taylor, city attorney. And I appreciate the feedback. I think that's really helpful. And just kind of for information of everybody here, we have been posting public records related to Zenith on the city website. And so you can go to the Portland GovQA, that's our public records portal. You can find several instances there where we have posted public records. One of those that's posted is the Cable Houston contract and the scope of work. So that's available online for folks. And the scope of work basically is, we're going to ask for documents, get documents. City staff is going to develop a work plan. Cable Houston's going to review that, provide edits on it. And then, I'll just be honest with you, this is one of the challenges of this audit, is that some of the subject matter experts in the city of Portland regarding city code and compliance with city code are city staff people. They just are. That's what they do for a living. They know more about it than anybody else, including outside counsel. So the challenge there is you sort of have to rely on them to go through the documents, do the research, put it all together. And that's why you'll see in the scope of work that ultimately the city attorney's office, with the help of those staff, we're going to put the draft together. Say this is what we think the facts show. And then, and this is the critical part, we give it to outside counsel. And what I have told folks, and including outside counsel, is they have full discretion, full authority. They can go through that thing and say, we don't think you looked hard enough at this. We think you were wrong about that. We think you need to ask for more documentation. And they have sort of full authority to go line by line in that work to make sure they think it's accurate or well done or not. And explicitly in the scope of work, the outside counsel is empowered to say in writing where they disagree. right? So they can give us the feedback, we can take it. And if they disagree with it and think we didn't do a good job or it wasn't thorough or we just were wrong in our conclusions, they say that. And I think that's important transparency for the public. So that is the basic way that this is designed, both to kind of get the benefit of the subject matter experts that work at the city, but with this outside lens through outside counsel who has full authority to pick it apart. So that's the basic idea.
Gotcha. Thank you so much for laying all that out for us, Robert. And I actually kind of like this dynamic where you presented, we got testimony that was able to help us create more questions, and then you're able to help us again.
That was an excerpt from the Thursday morning meeting of Portland City Council's Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee concerning the investigation into the city's dealings with Zenith Energy. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea.
Mr. Nana Now, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Rose City Native Radio. Coming up today, we have some